Okay, so this is February 5th, 2008, and my name is Ashley Maynor, and I'm here with Pam Young at Mr. Jim Bullington's home, and we are interviewing him about life in South Roanoke. And this is the second part of our interview.
Well, let's make it more life in Roanoke rather than just South Roanoke, because I didn't stay out there anymore. I had to.
Did you spend a significant amount of time in other areas of Roanoke, and can you tell us about those?
Like any kid, you know, you were here, there, and everywhere. I had a girlfriend who lived in Southeast, and then another girlfriend who lived in Grandin Court. Another girlfriend lived in Williamson Road, and you know these long-lasting love affairs you have in high school, 2-3 weeks, you know, one of them type things. You know, if you went with somebody for 3 weeks, it's almost like being married all your life. Roanoke, of course, was smaller then, and Jefferson High School, where I went, was the only high school in town. And for Roanoke, and Fleming was out there, and Bird was down in Vinton, and Andrew Lewis up in Salem, but Jefferson was a high school for all the Roanoke kids, whether you lived in Southeast or South Roanoke, Grandin Court, whatever. But anyway, we were talking, what were we talking about, downtown? And
you were telling us about downtown and how it was a gentler time, more respectful.
Well, you also got to remember our country was under, and you wouldn't remember this, and Pam wouldn't either, but our country was under a tremendous threat back in the early 40s with our war with Japan and Germany, both at the same time. And I remember World War II. Of course, I was just a kid, but I remember World War II. I was a junior commando, and we went around. We had a hat and a badge, and we went around to the homes in the neighborhood collecting grease. And then you turn the grease in, and somewhere along the line they used grease in the bomb making effort. Now don't tell me what they did. I don't know. But anyway, the entire mood of the country, we had won the war. So when you get to 1947, 1948, you've got all of these tremendous veterans, and I just wrote a story for the Roanoker last year on 6 different veterans from 6 different branches of the service, Navy, Army, whatever, that had come back from the war and had changed the course of history in this world, saved our country, of course, but they also saved the world from Hitler and from the advances of the Japanese government back then. And there was a sense of pride in this country that we did not start that war. We doggone sure finished it. But yet we didn't go in and try to capture any ground. We didn't try to take control of any country. We didn't. All we did was put Japan back on its feet. We put Germany back on their feet. We went home and left them alone. And if you look at pictures of men back in the 40s, early 50s, instead of wearing a hat straight on their head, I don't have a hat here, you'll see that those hats are cocked just a little bit. And it was just a, I'm an American, type of look that you might call it. And guys always cocked their hat just a little tiny bit. And the general feel was so much different than what it is today. As George Bush said, kinder, gentler time. But yet, it was a time also back then, for instance, if two boys got in a fist fight over something, and one boy knocked the other boy down, the fight was over. And if you walked up and kicked somebody when they were down, your own guys would jump on you. There was a sense of fair play. No matter what was going on, there was a sense of fair play. Nowadays, the fights just start when somebody goes down and 2 or 3 people stand there and kick them. That had been unheard of back when I was growing up. And you could get yourself seriously hurt by even your own friends if you did something like that. And I've seen it happen. Downtown, speaking of downtown, talking about downtown, it was just so much fun to go downtown because it was just packed with people. If you'd have walked out in front of my place, Texas Tavern, on a Saturday afternoon, say at 1 o'clock, and fired a shotgun down the street toward the fire station, you could have killed 500 people. As time went on and the shopping centers came along and the doctor's offices moved out of downtown and all of that, I've seen Saturdays when you could go out on the street and shoot a shotgun down the street and you wouldn't hit anybody. So that's how times have changed, the shopping centers and things like that. But when you went downtown, you never ran out of things to do. I mean, it was, if it wasn't standing on the corner in front of the Sportsman, which was at the corner of Jefferson and Church, and if you stand there, you see a vacant lot now, but you'll see on that wall, on that far, on that north wall, three outlines of where there was three stories of buildings there. On the bottom floor was the Sportsman drugstore and cafeteria, like a soda fountain. The second floor was a wonderful pool room. I mean, they had quality pool tables, and there were some big money games shot in that pool hall. Then on the top floor was a bowling alley, all in that one building. And then there was five movie theaters downtown. And the Roanoke Theater, which was on Campbell Avenue, which is about where, trying to think of how to place it. I don't know what business is in there now, but anyway, they were on Campbell Avenue, and they had vaudeville acts that came in every Wednesday. We had vaudeville shows, and there was everything from bands to comedy acts to dancing and hoochie coochie girls and all of that stuff. And I remember this, and I was playing trumpet back in those days, where I was learning to play. I've never forgotten this black band that came through. And I went backstage and got to talking to them. And one of the guys handed me a trumpet. And we all sat back there in a little room. And we had a jam session for about 45 minutes. There was a black lady that sang. Another guy played saxophone. A trombone player. I played trumpet. And I don't remember what all. But we had the best time. And they sent me a postcard from the next town they went to. I don't know where it was. And I don't remember the name of the group. But, oh, I had so much fun with those guys. The funny thing was, when they had the hoochie coochie shows with the girls there, I got in an argument with a lady who sold the tickets one day. I think I was 14, and I used to like the musical acts. I mean, they had the hoochie coochie girls, but they always had the musical guys there too. And I could buy a child's ticket. I could buy a child's ticket then because I was 14. I think the age break, maybe it was 14. Yeah, it was 14, come to think of it. You had to buy adults over 14. By the time I got to be about 14, I remember one time I went to go, and they told me I couldn't come in because there was the vaudeville girls were there. And I said, well, I have to buy an adult ticket. If I have to buy an adult ticket, that means I'm an adult. So the lady said, well, I'll have to check with my manager. I said, well, get your manager to come out here. So he came out, and I told him, I said, now, if y'all are going to sell me a child's ticket, then, you know, I can't come in. But if I have to pay for an adult ticket, then that means I'm an adult and I can come in and see whatever's going on. He said, sell the boy a ticket. So I went in, and it was a nice show. But then the... Oh, it was a nice show. Anyway, the Rialto Theater was, that was a great spot to go on Saturday afternoons. We'd go down there, and Saturday mornings I'd ride streetcar downtown, go to YMCA and swim, and I'd go down to, well, Saturday was, I'll back up a little bit. Saturday was payday. I got paid 25 cents a week for doing all my chores around the house. I had to cut the grass, carry the garbage out. In cold weather, I had to shovel the coal into the stoker to feed the furnace. And anything else that my mother or dad found to do during the week, you did. You didn't get paid per job. You just got paid 25 cents a week to do what you were told to do. And so Saturday morning, I got paid. I got my quarter. Well, it cost a nickel to ride a trolley downtown. So I go downtown, I go to the Y and I'd swim, I go down to the tavern. My dad didn't charge me for lunch then, all the time. Maybe he did some, but anyway, I could usually eat free. So I went on down to Rialto Theater. Well, I had 20 cents when I got to the Rialto. It cost 15 cents to get in. Now, for that 15 cents, you got to see a double feature Western, a Hoot Gibson, RKO News. There was usually a couple of cartoons on. And the movies just ran continuously. There wasn't any stop to it. It wasn't where there was a 30-minute break or 15-minute break. So you could go in at 1 o'clock and still be sitting there at 10 o'clock at night if you wanted to. Nobody say anything to you. Well, the big problem for me and where I had to make a big decision was I spent a nickel on the trolley out of that quarter. I spent 15 cents to get in the movies. That's 20 cents I spent, and I got a nickel left. They're popping that fresh popcorn out there in the lobby. I mean, I'm a kid with an endless stomach, like any kid. They're popping that popcorn out there, and I got a nickel left. And it's either save that nickel and ride the trolley home or take that nickel and go out and buy a bag of popcorn. I haven't ever ridden that trolley back home. I don't know what it's like to ride that trolley back south. I had to walk it every time. So, but you get that bag of popcorn and you'd eat a little bit, but you didn't want to eat it all at one time because there's another movie coming on. And you might want to sit through the first movie again too. Especially, you know, they were all Westerns. And all the good guys wore white hats and the black guys wore black hats. And oh, it was so much fun. I mean, it was just so much fun. My grandfather used to come over here from Huntington, West Virginia. And, he loved to go to the Western movies. And he and I'd go down there. I didn't have to worry about that popcorn because my granddaddy always had a little extra change in his pocket. And he'd just give me a 10, 15, 20 cents and say, you go out there and get what you want. But he only came over about once a year. But I used to love to go to movies with him. But when you came out, there was always something going on downtown to entertain you. And even when I was 9, 10, 11 years old, walking around downtown, afternoon or the evenings, you were safe. There wasn't anything to worry about. There was, adults, if you're walking down the street and if somebody would approach you that had bad intentions or anything, there'd be another adult man walking by and he looked over and saw it. He didn't keep walking. He stopped and turned around and he'd say, "You okay, boy?" And if you weren't okay, he'd say, "I don't know." And he'd look over whoever was causing trouble and say, "You better move on." It was just a different time than what it is today. But I used to stay downtown, awfully a lot. And it was just a wonderful experience. And I can think of Elmwood Diner, which was close to where the library is. It was on Jefferson Street there. A fellow named Bill Riley owned Elmwood. A great big old tall guy. And later, as I got a little bit older, I would get jobs around the neighborhood, cutting people's grass and shoveling the snow for them in the wintertime. And one day I made $5. And I started out about 8 o'clock in the morning with a shovel. And I didn't come home till dark, and I made $5 that day. That's big time money. That was big time money back then. Because you stop and think, you get in a movie for 15 cents. Comic books were 10 cents. Coca-Cola was a nickel. What do you pay for a Coca-Cola today? $1.50? So you got $5 and you only spend a nickel of it for, Coca-Cola. Of course, my brother, that's where the problem came in for me. He was 7 years older than me and he was smarter than me and he could always con me out of that money. So I got to where I'd have to hide it so I wanted to keep it. He could always sell me something or rook me out of it. He was a talker. Later in life, he and one of his partners built a Holiday Inn Tanglewood, so he was an entrepreneur. But it was good for me to stay away from him because he was slick. He was pretty slick. But that's about it on downtown, I think. We had the American Theater down there, which was a beautiful, beautiful theater. A lot of ornamental work inside, pretty dental work, and some of the cities around the United States, like in St. Louis and San Antonio and, a few places all over, I guess. Some of the grand old theaters are still standing. And the American was a beautiful, beautiful theater. The Hines family owned it, and that was where the new movies in town always came, and that's where the Miss Virginia pageant was held every year at the American Theater. And anytime there was a real classy act, that's where it was. We had another place called the Star City Auditorium, which was, I can't remember exactly where it sat, but it was on the other side of what we call the Henry Street Bridge. It's a Martin Luther King Memorial Bridge now, but it was on the other side of that bridge and just up the hill a little bit. And there was an auditorium there, and they played basketball games there. They used to have boxing matches there. And on Saturday nights, they had rock and roll and bands that would come in for the blacks to dance to. The whites could not. Now, this is when I was 15, 16 years old. Whites could not go down on the floor and dance. It was for the blacks. But we could pay a dollar and go up in the balcony and listen to the music and watch them dance. And we used to go over there a lot on Saturday night. And Louis Armstrong came to town. And I met Louis Armstrong there. I was just starting to play trumpet then. I'd played for, I don't know, a few years. But anyway, not many blacks came because it wasn't their type of music. And I bet there wasn't 20 blacks on the floor, and usually there'd be 400 or 500. And so in between one of his breaks, I went down from the balcony, and I walked up to the stage, and I started up the steps on the side. I got up on the stage, and I started off to the right, and I could see Louis sitting in a room in kind of an easy chair like this. And these two big gorillas came over to me, and this one guy looked down at me. He said, "Where do you think you're going, boy?" I said, "I got to see Mr. Armstrong." He said, "Why?" I said, "I'm a school reporter. I'm going to do a story on him." And Louis was sitting in there, and I remember that gravelly voice. Said, "Do you know who Louis Armstrong is?" Well, or was. Oh, fabulous guy. But anyway, he was sitting there in that chair just like I'm facing you, and I can remember him looking over, and he said, "Let the boy in." So the guy said, he said, "Go on, kids." So I went in and sat down, and I talked to Louis for about 5 or 10 minutes. Man, what a great experience. He was just so nice. And he said, "What kind of story you got to write, son?" I said, "I just wanted to meet you." I said, "I'm a trumpet player, too." He just laughed, and we started talking. We talked a little bit about playing the horn, and he gave me some tips. I was so excited, I can't tell you what he said. But I got him to sign a little autograph thing for me. I think my mother threw it away later. She didn't realize how valuable it was. But I remember when I left there, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. I better skip that. It was a long walk home. I'll go ahead and tell you because it turned out okay. But when I got to the bridge, it was full of young black men standing on that bridge, and I bet there was 200 or 300 of them. And he, that little white forehead and blue eyes came walking up. You could have heard a pin drop. And I knew I was in trouble. And I saw this one guy standing over there, and he's a pretty good-sized fella. And I knew I couldn't turn and run. I walked over to him, and I said, "Am I going to be able to walk down through here safely?" He looked at me kind of funny, and he said, "Yeah, since you ask." He looked down at all of me and said, "Y'all step back and let this boy walk through." And I walked down through, and I could just hear knives clicking as I went down through. And I heard a few little guys make a few comments, but I walked very slowly and confidently till I got about 10, 15 yards past them. And I want to tell you something. I set the world record for running the 2-minute mile. When I got down to, as you go down the Henry Street Bridge, now you get down to Salem Avenue and then Campbell Avenue. I made it from Campbell Avenue to South Roanoke in 1:12. I ain't slowed down yet. I didn't go over there again like that by myself. But I couldn't drive back then. You couldn't drive till you were 16. So, but then that place burnt down. I forget exactly when it burnt down, but it burnt down. It might have been when I was overseas. Let's see. That pretty much is it, except, you know, of course, we had Victory Stadium, and that was the center of all the sporting events, and it was, oh, man, at Victory Stadium. Oh, I got some fond memories. I got to tell you about that. VPIVMI game, of course, was the event of the year, every year at Victory Stadium. I mean, everybody, then the schools, the cadets would march from downtown out to the stadium, the hotty-tighties and all the cadets at VPI, and they all had to be in the military the first 2 years there. I think it was 2 years, 1 year, maybe it was 1 year, but anyway. And then the stadium would just be packed. I mean, if you could get a ticket to the VPI-VMI game, other than up in the nosebleed section, but if you could get on the 50-yard line or somewhere like that, you were somebody. You knew somebody if you got tickets there. Well, anytime anything came to the stadium like that, no matter what it was, us boys didn't have any money to pay to get in and see it. Well, they always used this one, most of the time, they used this one off-duty police officer named Claude Moore. And Claude was the greatest guy that it was ever been on the police, or one of the greatest that's ever been on the police force. Just as nice as he could be, and he loved his boys, and we'd all get over. If you go down Jefferson Street, you'll see where that fence goes down to the river. All us boys would get down there, be sitting down there on the riverbank next to the fence. Well, Claude was, his job was to patrol the fence to make sure nobody rolled the fence and snuck into the game or whatever was going on there at the stadium, you know. So I'd see Claude, I'd wait until he'd be walking back and forth up on the top. So me and my buddies, we'd go down and I'd kind of wave to him like that. And he'd act like he didn't see me, but he'd do like that. And we'd all walk down there and sit down on the bank. And then he'd let most of the crowd get in, you know, and things, maybe get started inside where nobody's paying any attention. And then Claude would come on down the fence and he'd say, "All right, boys, come on, hurry up, let's go." And all those would climb a fence and sneak in. We didn't sneak in, Claude let us in. But we'd get into the tech game, the VPI, VMI game, or the stock car races, whatever was going on there. But I can remember Claude said he'd just be grinning, just beat the band. And he'd say, "All right, boys, come on, y'all hurry up, let's go." And we'd all jump the fence and he'd say, "Take off now, get going. We'd get in there. I'd see Claude downtown or something every now and then. I'd say, "Claude, we got a game Friday night." He'd say, I know. He said, "Just wait till dark and I'll let you in," or something like that. But Claude always looked after the boys. I don't think we ever went over there. We didn't get in to see what we wanted to see. Not if Claude was working anyway. And if another cop was working, it wouldn't let you roll the fence. Somebody would go up and distract him, and then we'd get over the fence anyway. You'd do something, you know. Take some firecrackers, go on up the fence a little bit. You set off a couple of firecrackers, he'd run over there to see what's going on. We'd be down there jumping the fence. There was always a way to get in. There's a means to it in. But it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Stock car racing came along, and early NASCAR back in the early 40s, Curtis Turner was one of the greats in stock car racing many years ago. He's kind of like Dale Earnhardt was before he got killed. Curtis Turner was big-time stuff in NASCAR. Curtis, of course, was a Roanoke guy, and I'd gotten to know Curtis pretty well. And I used to go to races all the time, and I did some work on race cars, and I did a little bit here and there. And I remember one time, Curtis was a tremendous driver, and I remember one time I was over there at the stadium, and back then when the factories would give these guys cars to race, like for the NASCAR type stuff, you know, then they would give them a finished car just like you would get off the showroom floor, and then we'd go to work on them and take the seats out and take the windshields out, take the radios out, and then we'd build race cars out of them, and I helped build some race cars many years ago. Well, Curtis came driving up in a new Oldsmobile 88, and back then that was a hot rod, fast. And we were all standing around talking. He said, "Well, I'm going to take this car out on the track and try it out a little bit." No seat belts, no nothing. He looked over at me and he said, "Jimbo, you want to go?" I said, "Yeah, I'll ride with you." I never did that again. He had my eyes like that. First time in my life I ever stared death in the face. And he was just sitting over there laughing. Had that front wheel raised that far up off the ground going through those turns, sliding that car. I'm holding on to the door handle in the back of the seat. Oh, slow this thing down, Curtis. Boom, or down we went. But he actually built the Charlotte Motor Speedway. He was responsible for building the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And Curtis won a tremendous amount of races. I mean, you just didn't beat Curtis Turner. You didn't beat Curtis Turner on this track down here. I remember I was down in the pits one time, and I knew a lot of the drivers, and I stayed around the race cars most of the time. And this one guy had a car, and he had been out warming it up, and he came in, and he was just cussing that car up one side and down the other, talking about how the car wouldn't run. And Curtis was standing there, and he said, "What's the matter with it?" And the guy said, "I don't care. The blankety blank thing just won't run." Curtis said, "Let me try it thing out." So Curtis got in that thing, took it out on the track. He had that thing smoking by the second track around. And when, I remember him coming down the straightaway. When he went into the turn, he had that left front tire that far up off the ground. And that car was just sliding through that turn. Everybody in the pits was looking at him. I mean, he was burning that track up with that car. Came in and he jumped out. He said, "Yeah, you're right, it won't run." And turned around, walked off, and everybody just laughed at that other driver. The other driver was just scared of the car. He was scared to mash down on it. And Curtis wasn't. When Curtis got in the car, that gas pedal was on the floorboard, and off you went, whether you was ready or not. Off he went. And Curtis did a lot of things. He did a lot of lumbering. And matter of fact, his daughter is a friend of mine in town. Her name is Sue Wright, Sue Turner Wright. She's a local artist. And Sue and I went down to Danville together about 2 years ago. She wanted to enter a convertible in a Mexican road race to duplicate a car that Curtis raced in the Pan Am race down there back in probably the 50s. Yeah, 50s, because we looked at a 55 Ford convertible down in Danville. And I had a local mechanic that has worked on Indianapolis race cars and some other type of racing, and I took her down to meet Smokey and see if he'd build a race car for her to take down to Mexico to run that road race down there. It's an 1,800-mile race. And she wanted me to go and be on the pit crew. Not me. I ain't going there. I don't want to do it now. I would have been a years ago, but not now. But she's still in town. Her husband is Barry Wright, and he owns a publishing company here in town. Sue's a fabulous artist. I did some photography with her in her studio. But that's Curtis's oldest daughter, and she and I got together. It's been a while since I've talked to Sue, probably a year, but I get an email from her every now and then. But we enjoyed trading stories about Curtis, and I told her some things about her daddy she didn't know. Some of them she didn't want to know. I'm just kidding.
Tell us a little bit more about your experience, your association with the Texas Tavern, and about your career as you got a little bit older.
Well, Tavern has always been in our family. My grandfather was advance man for Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus back in about 1910, back in that era, 1920. That's when circus was really big-time stuff because there wasn't any entertainment like you have today. There wasn't movie houses and things like that. And when the circus came to town, the circus was in town. And he had his own private railroad car. He'd be a year ahead of the circus booking dates in various cities. He was in San Antonio, Texas, and he stayed in a hotel there, and he ate some chili they had, and he really liked it, so he asked the chef to give him the recipe. And he just kept it because what he had in mind someday was settling down, and it was about 10 towns that he had listed that he liked, that he wanted to eventually settle in one of them, of course. And it turned out to be Roanoke. So he came to Roanoke when he finally... Yeah, no, she did some other things in between, which are not important. Anyway, ended up in Roanoke. And there's a fellow named Henry Bullington, who's deceased now, but We're no kin, but we got to be great friends. Henry was a salesman for Thurman and Boone Furniture Company, which used to be down at the corner of Church and Jefferson where the old Hieronymus building was. It was Thurman and Boone Furniture Company. One of the partners was a gentleman named Edgar Thurman, and he was a bachelor, never married, and a tremendously wealthy fellow when he finally passed away. He owned the land where the Texas Tavern sits now. He owned that and the two parcels up above there. Well, Henry Bullington said my grandfather walked in the store one day, and Henry happened to be standing there, and he walked over to Mr. Thurman. Remember exactly the wording, but he said something to the effect, "You own a piece of property up the street here," and he said, "I'd like to talk to you about leasing it." And Mr. Thurman asked him what he wanted to do, and he said, "Well, I'm going to build a little restaurant and put it there, a little lean-to type restaurant." And he said, "I'd like to discuss it with you." So they went up the street, and Henry Bullington saw him walk out the door and go up the street. A little bit later, they came back. Well, they shook hands and struck a deal. And Mr. Thurman retained ownership of the property. He wouldn't sell the land, but he leased it to my grandfather. And my grandfather built the Texas Tavern on that land, and he opened it on Friday, February the 13th, 1930. Your bad luck day. He ran it for a few years, and then in 1934, he went over to Lynchburg and built another Texas Tavern over there. Well, of course, I hadn't been born yet. From what I heard from my parents, his health began to fail a little bit. My father had been living and working down in Florida. He was in his 20s then. He came up and went over to Lynchburg and started running that tavern, and my grandfather ran the one here in Roanoke. As the war began to approach, and even a couple of years before that, my grandfather's health had begun to get bad. So my father sold the tavern in Lynchburg and moved to Roanoke, and then he bought this tavern from his dad, or took it over, whatever they did. I don't know. My grandfather died about 1942 or 43. I don't remember very much about him at all. Anyway, my dad ran it for a number of years, and I never worked there a day in my life when I was a kid. And I went in the service and came back and ended up in San Antonio for a while, met my wife, we got married, eventually came back to Roanoke, and I was selling real estate and just loved it, and everything was going very well for me, but my dad's health began to fail, and I knew that if something happened to him that I would have to do something with the tavern. I didn't know anything about it at all, and so interest rates had gone up a little bit in the real estate field, or housing field, mortgage area. So sales had slowed down a little bit, so I thought that was probably a good time. And I had two kids on the runway and one in the hangar, so I thought, you know, maybe I better look into this tavern thing, just in case something happens to my dad, because I got to do something with it anyway. So I started working night shift. He put me to work nights. It was closed at nights during that period of time. And he opened up night shift and put me in, after training me for a few weeks, put me in as night manager and started me at $65 a week. He really wanted me to have big income, you know, lots of money. I had almost three kids. I got a wife and a mortgage and a car to pay for. I started out at $65 a week. So I sold vacuum cleaners door to door during the daytime to make ends meet. And I'd sold vacuum cleaners in college for 5 years, so I knew how to do that. So I'd go to work at 8 o'clock at night at the tavern, get off at 6 in the morning, and I'd go home, shower, and rest a little bit, and take a little nap or something. I'd go out and start selling vacuum cleaners. But eventually one thing led to another, and I ended up being over on day shift after a few years. And the general manager had some problems, and he left, so I took over that job. And then after a few years of that, I had some ideas that I thought needed to be put into place, and my dad didn't want to do anything different. And I mean, he'd run it the way he'd run it for a number of years, and I can understand why. But I wanted to put in air conditioning for one thing, because it was hard in the summertime to keep help working, because it would get so ungodly hot in there, you can't believe how hot it would get in there. And customers would go to air-conditioned restaurants, because July and August in a little place like that with all the people packed in there, you just can't imagine. You just can't imagine how hot, and especially for the working behind the counter, because then we had those heavy cloth hats that we wore, didn't, instead of the open hats. I got rid of the cloth hats and put in the open hats, and my dad thought I was, it was just terrible. I finally put in air conditioning and did some things like that. So I told him one day, I said, you know, one of us has got to retire, and I'm too young. So, you know, if you want to keep running this thing, I'll go back in the real estate business or whatever. And he said, well, I've been here long enough. So anyway, I started buying it, and I ran it for 38 years. And my son is a graduate of Roanoke College. He finished Roanoke College 8 years ago, and he started working part-time a little bit in college. He didn't work there during high school either. I never pushed him to work there. I wanted it to be his decision if he wanted to be a part of the business. It had to come from him, not from me. His life ain't my life. And so he worked for a number of years, and then he expressed an interest to me, and that's what he wanted to do. He loves it, and he just does a great job with it. And so we sat down and kind of worked out an arrangement and agreed on it. And so I'm still the owner as of today, but he's buying the business. It'll be his someday. But that basically is kind of how the four generations came along in there. We don't change anything. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know. And he pretty much respects tradition. Every now and then, he'll think of a little odd or end thing that needs tweaking, and he runs it by me. And all of his ideas usually are good. And he's better looking than I am and smarter than I am, so I don't argue with him. he does a great job. And it's freed me up to, I love the photography business I've got. I'm doing a lot of freelance photography. I do things like, I do the Carillion helicopter photography. I do Miss Virginia pageant, Roanoke Symphony Orchestra, Audubon Quartet at the Shenandoah Conservatory of Music. Paid my expenses to come to Winchester last week and do their photography. And I'm starting to do some photography for a major dealership here in town, which I can't call their name right now because we haven't done the website nor the advertising work. I do photography for Roanoke County School Board. I have a regular feature in the Roanoke Magazine, and I do a lot of freelance photography for all of their publications, Blue Ridge Journal and Pinnacle Home Mountain, Roanoke Magazine, New Virginia Guide. And I do a lot of portrait photography. I do families and individual portraits, and I do a lot of model photography. Actually, I've always enjoyed photography, but with the tavern being a 24/7 business, I didn't try to get into it on a professional level, because it's very demanding. There's so much technology involved that you have to learn today if you want to do quality photography. And, the opportunity presented itself when Matthew took over the business, and it left me free to start doing what I wanted to do. One of the first things I did was I went to Kevin Hurley, who's Roanoke, I think, is one of Roanoke's premier photographers, and I told Kevin what I wanted to do, and I worked out an arrangement with him, sort of an arrangement, where I just kind of became the studio pack mule in exchange for him teaching me portrait and wedding photography and commercial photography. And I'd go over and I'd sweep the floor, I'd move lights, I'd carry stuff out to the truck if we had an outside shoot. I helped reflectors. I was just kind of the pack mule. And but then we'd go on a shoot, I'd carry all the equipment and everything. Kevin would walk along and we'd get it set up, and then when he'd start shooting, He let me bring my camera, and he started showing me what to set things on, why you set them on, what you do if the sun is this way. I mean, I won't go into all the detail, but just started teaching me the basics of it. And there's two other photographers I got to be friends with, I started shooting with. And then there's one particular lady photographer that's just become a very, very good friend, and I do a lot of work with her. I help her on weddings, and I started doing wedding photography. And people liked what I was doing, and I had a call this morning from a lady in Dublin, Virginia, to come up there and do a wedding for her daughter. So one thing just kind of led to another, and I work at it. Well, I do it. Somebody asked me the other day how many hours a week I worked at this, and I said, I haven't worked a day since I left the tavern, but I put in 50 or 60 hours a week at this. Are you familiar with the kitchen tour that they do every year here? They got one coming up in April. I can't say too much now because they haven't started promoting it. But I shot all the kitchens for this cabinet company. I went into 5 different homes and photographed their new kitchens. And it'll be in April. Then it'll be featured in the Roanoke also. It keeps me busy. I really enjoy it. And I've had models come here from Washington, High Point, Greensboro, Lexington, Waynesboro, Tennessee, Williamsburg. That one girl drove a round trip from Williamsburg one day to shoot. She left early in the morning, got here about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I worked with her till about 4 o'clock, and she took off back to Williamsburg. That's between Richmond and Norfolk. That's a long drive. I wouldn't drive that far to work with me. Anyway, so that's a long answer to a short question, I guess.
Was there anything else you'd like to tell us that we haven't asked you about, or anything you want to add that we could have missed?
Actually, I don't know. Nothing I can specifically think about. I have a lot of memories of wonderful things about Roanoke. Robert's swimming pool, which was out on Lee Highway when I was growing up. That's where all the kids went in the summertime. And Lakeside, which was an amusement park with a swimming pool. And you either went to Lakeside or you went to Robert's swimming pool when you were a kid. But and I remember when they lit the star on Mill Mountain, Mr. Kinsey did that. So he did all of our sign work at the Texas Tavern. I knew all the Kinsey family real well. The thing about Roanoke, and when I was in the service, I was all over the Far East, and I've traveled a lot of other places too. And matter of fact, that's what that big empty structure outside is. My wife and I had a large motorhome, diesel motorhome, that we traveled for 17 years around the United States and Canada. I drove 140,000 miles in motorhomes going into every city you can think of. I'm from Miami to Chicago to Los Angeles to Seattle, Washington to Denver, Colorado to Montreal, Canada, Nova Scotia, Alberta, Canada, New York City, San Antonio. You just, and about any little town you can think of in between. And I can tell you there's some wonderful country out there. There's some beautiful country out there. There's a lot of things that are worth going to see, but ain't any of them like Roanoke, Virginia for year-round living. With the environment that we've got here, with the climate that we've got here, with the attitude of the people here, the generally safe environment that we live here. I mean, you can get in trouble anywhere, if you're in Roanoke, if you try hard enough. If you really work at it, you can go find trouble anywhere you want to. But I can go downtown at 10 o'clock at night and get out and walk around down on the market or go up to the Texas Tavern or walk up and down Church Avenue or Jefferson Street. I was doing a cover shoot for a magazine 2 years ago, and I took a model downtown 11 o'clock at night and set my lights up out in Jefferson Street and was taking shots of her in a formal evening gown. at midnight out in the middle of the street, and I felt just as safe then as I feel sitting in my own living room today. We need to keep a lot of younger people in Roanoke. We need to see a lot of progressive things. We got a couple of people on city council that the sooner they leave, the better off the area is going to be. But we've got a good city government. We've got a good city manager. We've got a lot of good things in place here. And for year-round living, there's just nothing like Roanoke, Virginia. So, I mean, I can think about any area of town, whether sometimes I go up on the mountain if I'm doing some photography of the city, and I just sit there and I look out over the entire valley and I just think, you know, how lucky I am to live here, to live in this area. Think about some of the areas you could be living, the south side of Chicago, east side of Los Angeles, New York, anywhere where Hillary Clinton is. You better not be a feminist. Yeah, one of the worst beatings I ever had in my life was on that playground out there. I got in a fist fight with a boy, and I got the better part of the fight, but I made the mistake of turning my back on him and walking away, and he jumped on me from behind and got my hair and just started banging my head down on that asphalt and like to kill me. I was scared to death that boy for about 2 weeks.
But you made it.
Huh?
Do what?
Huh?
You survived that beating, I guess.
Yeah, I beat hell out of him about 2 weeks later. Yeah, I was on my way to a music lesson. He came across the street and he said, "I'm going to beat you again," or something like that. And I said, "Well, we might as well get it on." So we did. But we were face to face that time. It was a little bit different. He didn't get me from behind. Mess with me anymore after that. Anyway, it was a great place to grow up and live. It was an entirely different environment. I love to go. I'm going to Jefferson Center Friday because I'm working with the symphony on developing some promotional stuff with them. And I wasn't a very good student in high school. I was more interested in shooting pool than I was going to school. So I had to go to military school for a couple of years. And this probably shouldn't be. We'll just skip this. That's all right.
Did you participate in any of the derbies?
Soapbox Derby?
Yeah.
I started building a soapbox racer 2 years in a row. Johnson McReynolds Chevrolet used to put that on. But I never had anybody to help me build it. And I didn't know how to build one. But I had the wood and everything. And I used to get the entry form and everything and fill it out. But you had to have somebody that had saws and drills and equipment and stuff like that. And I remember sitting down in my basement, had a handsaw, and that lumber would be laying around. And, I mean, I was 9, 10, 11 years old. I didn't know how to build one. But, so I never did participate in it, but I used to go watch them all the time. I was always a race fan, any kind of racing, but didn't make that one.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Wellington, for sharing all your stories with us.
Well, I hope that was worth your trip. It probably wasn't, but